Chapter 36, The Doctor's Visit. As soon as the professor entered the biosphere Saturday morning, a text came in from Dr. Rachel Khalid. This was not unusual, as they corresponded on a regular basis, mostly concerning the various animals and birds in the biomes. As the head doctor of the biosphere, Rachel Khalid oversaw all the decisions that were made regarding any living creature in her care. Looking at the new message, the professor read, "I'm very excited about the Paradise Venture and can't wait to show Farouk. We are both incredulous that miniaturization is possible. Farouk says he will have to see it to believe it. Please let me know when it will be possible to book a visit. Happy to share his experiment with others who loved it the way he hoped everyone would," the professor wrote back immediately. "Farouk is welcome to join you for a private viewing of Paradise before the scientists arrive. We actually are in need of some urgent medical advice. My first tiny is approaching the end of his expected lifespan and having chest pains. I promise to consult with the best doctors I know. I'd be very honored to have you and your husband visit tonight, if that works for you." The response was swift. Rachel eagerly promised to drop in with her husband when he was finished working at 6. After marking many final assignments that had been piling up in his inbox and finalizing the 3 exams he had scheduled for Monday, 6 o'clock rolled around quickly. Professor Lemans met Rachel in the Reptile Cafe. Tim, the maintenance man, was mopping the floors after a busy, slushy day with plenty of science students coming in and out. Lizards and turtles basked in the evening sunshine streaming through the glass, relishing the cool spray from the large waterfall. Having just checked on the macaws, the lovely dark-haired Jewish doctor had a bandage on her finger. She was excited to share Paradise with her husband. "I've been looking forward to this all day," she raved. "Farouk should be here in a moment. He had a last-minute emergency, or he might have been here earlier, but that's just the way it goes." "How was your day?" the professor inquired. She held up her hand with a wry smile. "Molly got me," she said. "Sa'alor, she drew blood?" Jax asked hesitantly. Molly had a bad habit of nipping, and Rachel often took abuse. "Yes," she nodded, "but we had 2 macaw chicks hatch out this morning, quite successfully, I'm glad to say. They are so adorable. I hope they will thrive. We also had a mother baboon attack a juvenile who was getting too close to her baby, so we separated them and treated the juvenile to prevent infection. Oh, and the polar bear cut its leg on an exposed screw, so we had to tranquilize her and clean all that up." She smiled kindly. "That was my day, Jax. How was yours?" Before he could answer, Farouk walked in through the blue-tented doors and his wife ran over to greet him warmly. A tall, swarthy man with curly black hair and very dark eyes, Farouk Khalid was an Arab Israeli. He and Rachel had met at the University of Tel Aviv. The Khalid's unlikely relationship intrigued Jax. He knew they had both been disowned by their families. Neither side had approved of the union, which was one of the reasons the couple had immigrated to Canada. The professor ushered them down the mirrored hall through his private office door that he was now quite happy to open to guests. As they walked into the viewing hall, Farouk said, "This boggles my mind, Jax. I would never in a million years have thought that successful miniaturization is possible." Smiling, the professor led the way to the large viewing window. Farouk was in awe as he and Rachel looked in. "Look at those hills," his wife pointed out, "and the lake and the lovely houses. What a delightful place to live." "So these are the tinies," Farouk smiled, peering in at all the teenagers sitting on the store deck. He cocked his head toward the happy, mingled voices coming through the speakers. "I suppose it's dinner time," he laughed. He looked in more carefully. "What are they having tonight?" "They make elaborate salads," the professor explained proudly. "I sent in a small cookbook, herbs and spices, and they have tried many things. Almost all their food comes from what they grow in their gardens. Some of them catch fish to fry or make into chowder." Glancing in carefully, he said, "It looks like quiche is on the menu tonight." "They have chickens and eggs?" Rachel inquired. "Oh, yes," the professor nodded, pointing to the farmland. "See the chicken yard right there?" The Khalids nodded. "Here's an interesting fact," the professor relayed. "None of the animals in Paradise have been able to reproduce, but the birds still lay eggs." "And the plants still flower and fruit," Farouk observed, noticing the gardens.
"Yes, yes," the professor nodded.
Inside the dome, Uncle Louis walked out from behind the store. He was now in full view of the visitors.
The older man there is Uncle Louis, the professor told Fairbrook. He is my first tiny and 4 years older than the rest. And since they grow and mature quickly, a year for every month, he is approximately 64, while the others are 18. He is the one having chest pains, Rachel clarified. The professor nodded. He is experiencing shortness of breath and pain in his chest when he exerts himself. Farouk Khalid leaned in to watch as Louis headed over to the orchards with Yu Yan for a private counseling session. He could lose a little weight, he observed. Yes, he could, the professor agreed. I'll ask Louis if he's been eating anything unusual. With a curious expression, Farouk asked, How did Louis tell you about his symptoms? Can you communicate with anyone in there? Explaining the cave with the internet connection, the professor told them how Louis was able to do video calls and research online. This is a remarkable setup, Dr. Khalid said with complete admiration. Louis is connected with you via a smartphone. Rachel looked over in awe. Nodding proudly, the professor relayed the emotional conversation he'd had with the older Tiny the night before. Perhaps I could do a video call with him, Farouk suggested. I could likely diagnose his condition through a series of questions and physical activities. He is far too small for more invasive tests. I sent him a blood pressure monitor. Perfect. That will help. If he has blocked arteries, would you recommend surgery? Farouk shook his head. I would never attempt to operate on someone so small. We haven't done enough research to know how his body would react under intensive surgery. I wouldn't know how to calculate anesthetics or medicine. Never mind have the precision required to open up his arteries and stitch them back up. Perhaps if I had the opportunity to practice a number of miniature operations, my success rate might rise, but I'd hate for Louis to be my first case. But if it was his only chance to live, would it be worth the risk? Rachel inquired. Farouk shook his head. If he indeed has blocked arteries, I believe we'd be far better off to encourage him to change his diet and try some medication. There is a new pill that has shown good success recently. I can try to determine a proper dosage for someone his size. He pondered the matter more carefully and shook his head. I certainly wouldn't recommend surgery. Would you have time to do a video call tonight? Jax asked, taking his phone out of his pocket. For sure, Farouk smiled. In a moment, Louis's number was shared with the doctor, and a text was sent through to notify Louis of the upcoming appointment. The Tinies had finished their meal and were bringing their dirty plates into the store. Who does all the dishes? Rachel asked with a smile. Or is that building equipped with a dishwasher? The kitchen crew see that it's done, the professor replied. Nancy and Milan run the store and kitchen, and they have a wonderful helper. Nancy came out of the store at that moment to take a pile of scraps to the compost area. Two rabbits hopped out of the bushes. Raising his prominent dark eyebrows in surprise, Farouk laughed. Some are willing to do all the dishes? They trade work for food, Jax replied. As he explained the way things operated in paradise, the trading system, the schooling, and free time, the doctors observed a stocky young man with tangled blonde hair approach the others. That's Odin, the professor told them. He then named all the young men who were standing around beside the store. What is Odin saying? Dr. Khalid asked curiously. The professor closed his eyes and took a deep breath as they listened carefully. He hoped Odin would be on his best behavior. Chapter 37, Boundaries. I have something very important to show you, Odin said dramatically, flipping back his long, messy blonde hair. Right now? Zahir questioned, rubbing one hand against his dark beard. Georgia is waiting for me on the hill. The sun will set soon, Damien objected. This is prime go-karting time. It's very important, Odin insisted. On the other side of the glass, the doctors smiled at each other. Go-karting sounds fun, they said. It is, Jax nodded. I hope you get to see them go down the hill. Anxiously, he wondered what Odin was up to. Right outside the store, their voices were coming through very clearly over the microphone. This is something you all need to see, Odin said solemnly. You can ride tomorrow night. Just the guys? Behid clarified, raising his dark eyebrows.
I'll show you guys tonight, and then we can talk about whether or not we tell the girls.
Jack swallowed hard. He felt a sense of dread. There seemed to be enough curiosity among the young men that they decided to comply. The girls who had overheard the invitation protested, since rarely had they been excluded. However, Odin was adamant that this was potentially disturbing. Therefore, he only wanted the guys along.
Rather typical, Rachel Khalid commented, rolling her eyes.
As the doctors watched, all the young men followed Odin toward the train tracks. The young ladies headed to the hill beside the store, mumbling their displeasure. A pretty blonde-haired teenager was already standing on the top of the hill beside a go-cart, watching the exodus of young men in a perturbed fashion. Her hands were on her hips. Odin marched proudly ahead of the others to the train tunnel, which was the closest point to the viewing hall window. All around the outer circular metal boundary were tiny holes through which fresh air filtered in. The light breeze ruffled the boys' hair and shirts.
"Have a good look at this," Odin said, patting the metal boundary.
"We've seen that before," Damien replied disdainfully. "It goes all around paradise."
"This is true," Odin replied, wiggling his thick blonde eyebrows. His pale blue eyes narrowed. "But have you ever stopped to think what it means?"
That's as far as we can go," Lima suggested.
"It means," Odin said very importantly, "that we are in a cage. There's a whole world outside this cage that we are barred from entering."
"What do you mean by cage?" Damien asked.
"It's like a giant pet chamber," Odin sneered. "People keep animals in pet chambers."
"Why would we want to go anywhere else?" Sahir asked. "We have everything we want in here."
"Because we are trapped," Odin protested, stroking his straggly blonde beard. "If something were to happen like another flood..."
"It better not," Sahir exclaimed, folding his arms across his chest. In the viewing hall, the doctors looked over at the professor curiously.
"I'll tell you all about it later," he sighed.
A rebel session led by Odin was not the introduction to paradise that he'd hoped to share. The flood was not the first story he wanted the Khalids to hear.
"That was an unfortunate accident," Odin said dismissively.
"And the professor sure took a long time to respond. There may be more accidents that we don't expect and he doesn't notice. We need to know how to escape in an emergency."
"What are you suggesting?" Kenzie asked, with a skeptical expression on his pale, freckled face.
"Well," Odin smirked, "since the train goes in and out of this tunnel, bringing supplies from the professor and Evan, then that means the train tunnel is our exit to freedom. They live out there while they keep us in their cage, watching us every day." He glared at the hazy horizon in disgust. "They may be watching us right now, and we can't even tell. We need to figure out how to get through to where they are."
Fran seemed to appreciate Odin's point of view.
"We could ride the train," he suggested.
The professor's mouth dropped open in surprise.
"I'm glad I'm hearing this," he laughed to the Khalids.
Inwardly, he felt dismayed.
"Ooh la la," he thought to himself. "I'll be putting alarms on that train tonight."
He was thankful that he and Evan had ensured the train was flush against the tunnel walls, with no room for a tiny to squeeze in between.
Odin smiled with delight. "Now you're thinking." He looked at Franz with a keen expression.
"But what if we need to escape," he prodded, "and the train has already come and gone? Then what?"
Franz pondered the matter. "There must be something that triggers that train door to open."
"That's what I think," Odin replied with a smug expression. "So I am suggesting that anyone who wants to find a quick way to exit paradise, should the need ever arise, helps us discover a way to open those doors. We can only do this when Uncle Louis isn't watching. It may require getting up in the middle of the night. Who wants to help?"
Franz and Ponzi put up their hands. Rachel and Farouk exchanged glances. Jax shuffled uneasily.
"I don't agree with this, guys," Sahir spoke up. "Uncle Louis has told us we wouldn't live more than an hour outside of paradise. The professor has made this world perfect for us. Uncle Louis says we will die if we enter the big world. I trust him."
I'm with Tahir, Kenzie proclaimed, moving closer and throwing his arm around his friend's shoulders. Vahid followed, then Charlie, Milan, and finally Lima. Six of them stood together. Damien didn't move. He stood alone. Odin was undeterred.
Ah, that's what he says, he scoffed. Maybe he just doesn't want us to try. He wants us to think we can't live outside of this dumb cage.
I don't see why you don't believe him, Sahir argued. Uncle Louis talks to the professor every night. He says he knows almost everything.
Rachel reached over and patted the professor's arm. They exchanged smiles. Kenzie piped up.
Why would you want to escape paradise? We have a great world to live in.
It's small and it's so boring, Odin replied. I want to see what's on the other side. I want to figure out what's really going on.
Franz moved closer to Odin.
I'd say finding an escape route is very important. The flood went on for a long time before anyone figured out what to do. We could have all drowned. If something else ever goes wrong, we need to know how to get out of here right away.
Anyone else want to investigate? Odin asked. Tonight can be our first scouting mission. We'll head out when Uncle Louis goes to bed.
Somewhat reluctantly, Pontsy drifted over to Odin's side.
Come on, Damien, Franz encouraged. This may save lives.
I just don't feel right about it, Damien demurred, rubbing both sides of his beard with his hands.
You have a good point and all, but, well, you are smart guys. I'm sure you'll find the way out if there is one to be found.
We'll be the heroes if we find a way, Odin boasted.
Sahir stood tall with determination. I will be telling Uncle Louis about this conversation, he informed angrily. I'm really disappointed. I thought you guys had learned your lesson.
You tell, and I will wreck your boat, Odin threatened fiercely.
For a moment, Sahir hesitated, but then he shrugged and spoke firmly.
Wreck my boat, that's what you want to do. I'm not going to let you wreck paradise again.
Doctors looked over at the professor.
I like this Sahir guy, Farouk nodded with a smile. He's got Shaja. You named him well.
What does Sahir mean? Rachel asked her husband.
Sahir is Arabic for light, like a light that shines in a dark place.
Nodding happily, the professor thought to himself, well done, Sahir. You were a bright light in a bad conversation. Waving his hand toward the young men who were separating in various directions, Farouk remarked,
you've got a few in there with great valor and some that are just looking for trouble.
Intrigued, Rachel looked over at Jax.
Where did all the children come from? She asked.
The Greenville University Center for Research, he replied quietly, watching Amy come out of the store and empty two pots of vegetable scraps into a carry cart. Nancy followed with one more.
The kitchen crew works hard, Farouk observed.
Jax agreed proudly. The kitchen is an excellent place to learn servant leadership.
Did you use embryos or human reproductive material? Rachel clarified as she watched the tiny dissipate.
Some of both, he responded carefully. But I only gathered from donors who gave full consent for unrestricted scientific research.
Oh, look, Farouk called out suddenly, pointing to the hill. The girls are driving the go-karts.
Rachel laughed.
So they are, she said, as they watched three go-karts of girls race down the hill together. Looks like so much fun.
After a momentary pause, Rachel curiously prodded a little further. So, of course, you wouldn't know specifically who the donors were for each child.
Non. That private information remains with the lab, he smiled gently.
The girls made it nearly all the way to the tracks, only a short distance from where Zahir, Kenzie, and Vahid now stood watching. Giggling, they got out, coaxing their friends to join them on the hill before it was too dark to see. For about 20 minutes, the doctors witnessed plenty of wild driving and lots of spontaneous laughter on Rose's Hill, until it got too dark to see. Meanwhile, Odin, Pontsy, and Franz shot vegetable targets in the forest and cheered each other on.
They are truly in paradise, Rachel smiled. Why would anyone want to get out?
That's what I asked myself, the professor replied with chagrin.
Teenagers often feel trapped by life's circumstances, Farouk chuckled. They burst out only to find the perfect world on the other side is not necessarily any better than the one they wanted to leave.
The professor looked up gratefully.
So true, he agreed. Leaving home can be a good perspective-altering experience.
But in this case, he grimaced,
bursting out of paradise would be the end of their lives. As darkness set in, the professor explained the intricacies of the tiny's existence and told the story of how he had first stumbled upon the miniaturization process. While he talked, the tinies left their go-karts at the edge of the forest and meandered home. Amy pushed her loaded carry cart up to the clearing. Eventually, Jax explained about the flood which Odin had referred to and told his visitors he had put new safeguards in place. Farouk wanted to know more about the ethics committee's threats and what that meant for the future. Stars were twinkling above the greenhouse structure when they finished discussing everything. Most of the tinies had gone to bed and Louis was making his way to the cave. Thankful that his guests had seen a little of the good times to balance the rebellious introduction, the professor led the doctors down the dark hall toward the door with the aid of the flashlight on his cell phone. The floor was lined with small lights, and so was the ceiling, but an extra light always helped. Anything brighter may have been noticed in paradise. Entering the warm, humid rainforest biome, Farouk sat down at the cafe table near the cascading waterfall, hoping to engage in a video call with Louis. Jax and Rachel took seats close to him. Once Louis saw the message he'd been sent, he responded quickly. A half-hour conversation took place with the older Tiny, interspersed with various tests and exercises. Eventually, the heart doctor confirmed that Louis was most likely suffering from blocked arteries. He discussed his diet, labeling honey buns and fried fish as likely culprits, and then explained the changes that needed to take place. Dr. Khalid encouraged Louis to stick with fruit, vegetables, and baked fish. "And I'll send in some medication for you tomorrow," he promised. As they headed out the large glass doors into the cool night air, Jax inquired further about the diagnosis. Farouk confided, "I'm afraid it might be quite a serious blockage. But a change of diet and this new medication should slow down the accumulation of unhealthy cholesterol." With a pause, he added, "It might be wise to tell all of your tinies to cut back on honey buns." Chapter 38, Restrictions. For the next few days, as various ethics committee members visited to soberly assess the situation, and Rachel came for her daily peek, the tinies used the solar box ovens to cook their bread. They had a good system going. If they inserted their loaves in about halfway through the school lesson, they were golden brown by the time Uncle Louis finished science. While the bread cooled, they spent time on the parabolic cookers, which were almost complete. Since the oven had broken, Amy had been extra busy frying large batches of honey buns with various types of fruit to help make enough food. Banana, cherry, and pear had all been popular, and she never seemed to fry enough. Every evening she set aside 1/3 of the buns for the morning breakfast rush, but there were always tinies asking for more when there were none left. The trades that came in had given her plenty of things to keep for herself or trade for something else. In particular, she was very proud of the well-crafted swinging bench Zaheer had traded, and which she still needed to figure out how to hang, and 3 beautiful pots from Vanitha. She had 5 flower bouquets decorating the girls' mansion, 10 free surfing shows from the Beach Boys, and enough free surfing lessons to last for a full 3 weeks, if she ever chose to use them. Odin and Ponce had brought over many rocks to the store and promised to create a patio and a stone table for the girls' mansion. However, they had not yet carried the rocks up Rainbow Hill. Amy told Nancy that the next time Odin and Ponce asked for honey buns, she would insist that all 50 rocks had to be carried up the hill first. Honey buns were basically all that Odin and Ponce had eaten in the last couple of weeks since Amy had been making plenty, and both of them had gained a lot of weight. Thankfully, Charlie and Santa were able to gather another pot full of honey from under the roof of the farmhouse, or production might have ceased. Not only did Amy have an amazing bench, pots, flowers, tickets, pretty pebbles, and lots of beads, but Georgia had traded a stunning Luna moth picture that she had painted. Sadly, Amy was in no mood to treasure anything from Georgia, and decided the artwork would trade well for something else. Dia promised to sew her a new dress for 3 weeks' worth of honey buns. Vahid and Kenzie had built her a much better carry cart, and the list went on. Needing the sweet dough that afternoon, Amy added the raspberries that Santa and Charlie had picked for her. As she mixed in the fruit, she thought about the ticket Lima had given her to watch a Shake It Up show that he and Santa were performing. I hope Charlie doesn't feel left out, she thought. Then she considered, is that against the no-hurting rule? Is it wrong to hurt other people's feelings? Outside of the kitchen, she could hear Zaheer, Georgia, Kenzie, and Vahid working on the xylophone. It had been one of the most complicated projects ever attempted in Paradise, but it was now sounding so good. How she wished she had been involved from the start. While Nancy kneaded the bread and Milan wrapped fish with spinach, spices, garlic, and onion, Amy imagined herself in Georgia's place. Nancy spoke up hopefully. Maybe soon we'll be baking fish in the parabolic cookers. Standing by the stove, shaping the dough into little sweet rounds to fry, Amy thought about the new solar ovens they used in the mornings. It has been so nice to cook outside the last 2 weeks, she thought with a smile. The worst part of dinner preparations is spending hours inside the walls of the kitchen. With a smile, she pondered the morning's activities. Her group almost had their parabolic solar cooker working. They just had to adjust the angle so the center point would provide enough heat. I do like my group, she thought to herself. I've enjoyed getting to know Kenzie, Tina, and Vahid. Uncle Louie walked into the kitchen. Amy noticed that his shirt was untucked and he was wearing ropes attached to his shorts to keep them up. What kind of honey buns are you making today? He smiled. Raspberry, Amy said, placing 12 in the hot oil. Oh, that might be my favorite, he declared. I love raspberries. Thank you, Amy replied. It's so fun making things that everyone wants. Yes, it is, Uncle Louie said with a deep sigh. Amy looked over at him with a puzzled expression. The sigh didn't seem to fit the anticipation of biting into delicious raspberry honey buns for dinner. She turned the buns over with a piece of wooden doweling. What's wrong? She asked. Uncle Louie sat down in a chair. Nothing's wrong, he told her. After a pause, he elaborated, It just seems that even though honey buns are absolutely delicious, eating too many may not be a good thing for our health. With great surprise, Amy turned away from the frying pan and looked at him with dismay. I don't want to distract you from your cooking, Uncle Louie assured her. Do you need to take those out? The golden buns were perfectly fried. Amy took them out and drizzled honey on top. Before adding any more to the pot, she asked Uncle Louie, What do you mean? I did some research, Uncle Louie told her, not mentioning that he had been doing hours and hours of fascinating research every night. It seems that honey and oil, while being very tasty, are also very fattening. Some of us have been getting substantially rounder, and I've wondered why. Even the professor has noticed, and now I've been asked to rectify the problem. Disheartened, Amy asked, Do I have to stop making honey buns? No, don't stop, Uncle Louie assured her, but we need to cut back. One honey bun per day is enough for everyone. But some of the guys have 6 or 8 every day, Amy protested. Uncle Louie sighed. I know, and well, I've been guilty of having 4 or 5 myself. He pointed to his protruding belly. Look at me. You can see I've eaten too many. Okay, Amy sighed. Should I throw out the rest of the dough? Tonight can be our last honey bun extravaganza, Uncle Louie declared cheerfully. But starting tomorrow, I'd like you to cut back to about 1/4 of the normal production. Amy nodded. She was very disappointed. Cutting back also meant she wouldn't get so many nice trading items. But the oven isn't working yet, she pleaded. Nancy isn't baking as much bread. Try the oven, Uncle Louie told her. Amy turned the dial on the oven, opened the door, and waited to see if it would heat up. Within seconds, she could tell the oven was fixed. With a sigh, she closed it up and folded her arms across her chest. You could increase their value, Uncle Louie considered, appreciating her loss of revenue. If there are fewer honey buns available, people might be willing to trade at a higher price for them. Amy looked over at Uncle Louie. All right, she agreed reluctantly. I'll cut back. That evening at dinner time, Uncle Louie explained to all the Tinies that while food was very important to nourish them and give them energy to work, too much honey, oil, and flour could make them unhealthy, plump, and tired. Amy and I have talked, he explained to everyone. Tonight is the last time you can eat as many honey buns as you want. After this, Amy is only going to make enough for one each per day. There were many shouts of disappointment.
Only one? But this is my favorite food.
I only eat honey buns, nothing else.
But I traded for 3 full weeks of honey buns, Dia complained, and I always get 2 for dinner and 2 for breakfast.
Settle down, everyone, Uncle Louis said, calming the crowd. We aren't completely getting rid of honey buns. We are just cutting back so that we don't become unhealthy and overweight. He turned to Dia. I'm sure Amy will fulfill your trade over 12 weeks instead of 3. Amy nodded reluctantly. There were a few trades that would now require a longer period of time. Odin was irate.
This is so controlling. We should be able to choose if we want to be unhealthy or not. Honey buns are the best thing ever. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning.
Who cares if we're a little stockier, Ponzi argued. I like myself better this way. Now I can wrestle Odin. You can't restrict honey buns.
I agree,
Lily added, quite pleased that she finally had a few curves. But even so, Lily only ate 1 honey bun a day. It's the professor's decision, Uncle Louis told them, and the professor knows what is best for all of us. He wants us to enjoy eating, but still be healthy and active.
I don't care about being healthy, Odin protested. I only care about food.
The rush on the raspberry honey buns that evening was more intense than ever. With Odin and Ponzi already so upset, Amy didn't have the courage to ask them to take the rocks up the hill first. The 2 most fervent honey bun lovers added 14 more rocks to the large pile outside. Some of the Tinies, who now understood why their clothes weren't fitting, requested only 1 honey bun for dinner. Amy put the extras aside for the morning, feeling sad about her delicious creation. She had never intended to make people unhealthy or plump. And now so many were upset with Uncle Louis for restricting the amount they could eat. Amy felt it was all her fault. As a tall, copper-haired girl left the store with her new cart full of scraps for the animals, she saw the beautifully decorated plaque with the 2 rules for paradise. Suddenly, a shiver went down her spine and she covered her mouth quickly with her hand.
Oh no, she thought, I was hurting people with my baking.
It was a terrible revelation that she had broken the rule while thinking she was doing something good.
If my board were still there, she gasped, someone might add, no baking things that hurt people. I just have no luck, Amy mourned as she pushed her carry cart towards Rainbow Hill. Everyone loves Vanitha's pots. They are useful, never hurt anyone. The professor hasn't had to restrict Vanitha from making pots. Why can't I think up something helpful to create?
A tear trickled down her cheek as she climbed the hill, but she wasn't even exactly sure why she was crying. Lately, everything seemed to be going wrong.
Chapter 39, Nancy. Heading out of her house the next morning to set out the raspberry honey buns and help with breakfast, Amy noticed that the new swinging bench was hanging from the veranda. Stopping to look in surprise, she wondered who had put it up.
It wasn't there last night, she said to herself.
As usual, colors had woken her early that morning, and there was still plenty of time before everyone would arrive for breakfast. With great delight, she sat down on the bench and enjoyed the gentle seesaw motion. It was comfortable and creatively designed from old wood. Best of all, it was made by Zaheer, and he hadn't made it for Georgia, Santa, Dia, or Lily. He had made it for her. Well, she clarified to herself with a measure of honesty, for me and for 2 weeks' worth of honey buns. She recalculated according to the new restrictions. I guess that'll now be 8 weeks. With a grateful smile, she thought, I would gladly give him as many as he wants for the rest of his life, but others might feel that was unfair. Happily, Amy swung back and forth, watching the 3 young deer grazing on the grass outside of her home. Freddo slowly waltzed over for his good morning cuddle, and colors swooped down from a tree branch and began to nibble at her hair.
You'll get your bread, don't worry, she assured him.
It suddenly occurred to her that she hadn't truly thanked Zaheer for the bench. He had brought it to the store as a trade item, while she had been busy finishing the eggs and getting ready to fry the fish. She had only said a quick thank you, which was not an adequate response for a favorite new possession. Quietly re-entering the house with her bird perched on her shoulder, Amy found a piece of paper. Georgia always had art supplies lying around the house, so it wasn't hard to find the necessary items to make a card. Back outside, she went to sit on the new bench and try and think of what to say. Colors flew to a tree, anxious to show her the way to the store, but Amy didn't notice. Fredo sat patiently waiting for a pat on the head, but Amy was deep in thought. "Zahir, I really love the beautiful swing," she wrote neatly. She hadn't intended to write a poem, but it just began to flow. "Of all the trades, this is my favorite thing. I love your style and the work that you do." Colors flew back to her shoulder and scolded the dog as Amy deliberated over the last line. Finally, she wrote the simple truth. "When I sit on the swing, I'll think of you." She would have liked to have signed it "Love from Amy," but she didn't want to break the girl's rule. So instead, she just wrote her name with a flourish. The card looked rather plain, so she added a few swirls. It still looked plain. "I could try to draw a flower," she pondered, "but that didn't seem right for a guy." "Zahir loves trees," she recalled. "I'll draw a tree." Not an artist like Georgia or Vanitha, the tree was more comical than realistic, but Amy was proud that it looked like a tree. One deer glanced over the moment she rose from the swing. "I'll bring you some more treats tonight," she told them, giving Fredo his long-awaited pat. Zoe nuzzled her arm as Amy walked past. Three little squirrels chattered to her from high up on a branch as she walked through the forest to Zahir's house. Looking up, Amy chattered back to them. Colors squawked noisily and tugged at her hair. "We'll go to the store soon," she promised, patting his head. The sky was still pink and streaked with yellow, and most of the tinies were sound asleep in their beds. Fredo slowly followed her back to his home. It was a much smaller house in the girls' mansion, but quite cozy and quaint. Nuzzling her hand, the golden dog leaned close for a cuddle. Amy could see through the trees that his master was out fishing with Lima. The door opened and Milan appeared. Looking surprised to see her, he asked, "What's up?" Kneeling down to stroke Fredo's soft fur, Amy answered, "I just wrote a note for Zahir to thank him for the swinging bench. Could you please give it to him for me?" "Sure," Milan nodded, taking the note from her. "I'll put it by his bed." As Milan disappeared indoors, Amy noticed that Fredo's eyes looked cloudy and his muzzle was even whiter. Sadly, she gave him a hug. "You and Uncle Louie are looking older every day," she said. "I wish you could still come with me to the bakery. You don't get to play with Rusty anymore." Fredo barked, and Amy shushed him. "The girls are still asleep," she said. "You have to be quiet." Hearing the bark, the loons called out and began beating their wings against the water as they took off into the air. Emma replied from underneath Damien's hammock. "Well, that'll wake the beach boys," Amy remarked wryly to the old dog. She had intended to wait for Milan, but he was taking a long while to return, so she decided to set off to the store before Fredo and Emma woke up anyone else. Charlie, Santa, Tina, and Yuyan were already out in the mango orchard picking fruit for breakfast. As usual, Santa was singing a happy tune while she worked. Since the new bats had pollinated the mango flowers, the trees were now loaded with ripe fruit. Amy waved to the farmers in a cheery fashion as she came close. Colors left her shoulder and flew to the trees. "No snacking," Amy told him. "Don't worry," Santa smiled, reaching for a mango on the ground. "He can peck this one. It's bruised." "When are you coming surfing again?" she asked Amy. "You should try today before Damien completely gives up on you." Amy shook her head as the words of defeat echoed in her mind. "He already thinks I'm a whoosh." It suddenly occurred to Amy that she could ask Santa what a whoosh was. "Oh, that's easy," Santa laughed, holding the mango out to Colors, who told into the flesh greedily. "A whoosh is a wave with no power," she explained, using her free arm to demonstrate. "You can't surf on a whoosh because it fizzles out before it gains intensity. Lima can spot them easily. I'm still learning." "A whoosh fizzles out," Amy considered in her heart. "Is that what I am? Do I give up too soon?" Santa remembered some exciting news. "Did you see that Zahir and Kenzie hung up the swinging bench?" she asked. Amy nodded fervently. "I did," she relayed with a bright smile. "And I swung on it this morning. It's so comfortable." Santa smiled, picking another ripe mango. "They hung it up last night, but you were already in bed." "I was tired," Amy remembered.
But I wrote Zaheer a thank you card this morning. I love his new bench swing. I looked at her with a slightly wary expression. Don't worry, Amy assured her sassily. I only said I loved the swing. Perturbed by the look and feeling the warning, Amy said goodbye and carried on to the store. Uncle Louis was sitting on his deck enjoying the view. Like the farmers, Uncle Louis was usually up early. Amy made her way around to the front of the store, but when she got there, she saw that Nancy was sitting on the front step crying. There was blood on her face and hands. What happened? Amy called out anxiously. The front door of the store had been torn off its leather hinges. There was a large, swollen red mark on Nancy's forehead, a cut across her nose, and her lip was bleeding. Rusty was by Nancy's side, nuzzling her arm anxiously, and Milan had not yet arrived. Odin and Ponzi stole the honey buns, Nancy wailed. I tried to stop them, but he hit me hard. Uncle Louis came around the corner, as did Charlie, Kenzie, and Vahid. I'll get the first aid kit, Amy called out, running into the store. Rusty barked and whined. Sitting down next to the injured storekeeper, Uncle Louis put his arm around her. What happened? He asked. Who did this to you? Nancy began her story again as Amy returned and sat down on the other side. Carefully, she wiped her friend's injuries with the antiseptic wipes. Apparently, the two young men had pounded on the door early that morning, waking Nancy up. She had refused to open the door for them until breakfast was ready, so they forced their way in. Seeing that Nancy was shivering, Kenzie ran into the store for a blanket. Returning quickly, he placed it around her shoulders. Nancy was very grateful. And who hit you? Uncle Louis inquired angrily. Taking out the antibiotic cream, Amy daubed it gently on her friend's face. She was thankful she could do something to help. Odin, Nancy relayed. I tried to stop him from taking the honey buns, knowing that everyone would want one this morning, and he pulled a board off the shelves and whacked me across the face. We should never have made honey buns, Amy lamented, applying soothing ointment to Nancy's bleeding lip. It's not your fault, Kenzie consoled her. You only wanted to make something good, and honey buns are amazing. Uncle Louis smiled up at him in full agreement. Kenzie is right. Don't blame yourself, Amy, he said firmly. The fault lies with those who don't restrict themselves. He smiled at her and waggled his eyebrows, like me. Once Nancy's wounds had been cared for and the bleeding had stopped, Uncle Louis ordered, You girls stay with Nancy. I've got to track down whoever did this. I'll come with you, Kenzie offered. Charlie and Vahid volunteered as well. Okay, guys, Uncle Louis nodded. Let's pay a morning visit to Odin and Ponzi. We'll ask them if they're ready for breakfast. With his troops, Uncle Louis marched across the grass. But no one answered at Odin and Ponzi's homes. When they opened the doors, no one was inside. Neither was there any evidence that the stolen honey buns had ended up there. In fact, the houses were so empty that Uncle Louis doubted either young man had been living in them. Those boys, he murmured. I guess I should have been checking inside their houses. Where have they gone? Let's check the forest, Kenzie remarked. I think they have some forts back in there. They all spread out and began exploring the forest. It had become very thick and overgrown with long dead grasses and a few fallen trees. But Charlie found a path. He motioned for the others to join him. Following the worn track through the firs, they came to a clearing. The large wooden catapult was aimed toward the store. They caught sight of a new contraption nearby. That must be the pebble launcher, Kenzie pointed out. Walking over, they all admired the well-built device. I'd like to try this out, Uncle Louis smiled, pulling back the elastic and letting it go, even if it does look rather dangerous. Near the launcher, several trees had been cut down to leave tall stumps. Arranged in the center of those stumps were rotten vegetables and fruit. Cutting down living trees, Uncle Louis whispered with a frown. That's totally unacceptable. What are they doing back here? I think this is the target practice area that Franz was talking about, Kenzie admitted softly. Sorry, maybe I should have told you about this. Yes, you should have, Uncle Louis agreed in a hushed voice. Are others involved? Kenzie looked down at the ground uncomfortably. Maybe you should ask. All right, I will, Uncle Louis said. There is a stash of dead treetops over here, Vahid said quietly. They all had a look. Branches with withered brown leaves were piled up all around inside the forest, but particularly in one place. Uncle Louis saw another worn path and stopped to examine the surroundings.
Piles of dirt lay everywhere, carefully dumped around the trees. Two carry carts stood quite a distance away with shovels leaning against them. Walking close by the dead treetops, Uncle Louis bent over and pulled at something on the ground. It lifted up, and then he gently closed it back down. Returning quietly to the teens who had joined him, he whispered, "I think I've found their den. Let's hide nearby and see if anyone comes out." Happy to comply, Kenzie, Charlie, and Vahid found a hiding place. Sitting in the forest, they waited silently. After a while, Uncle Louis began to wonder if the two tinies had gone back to sleep. Just when he was going to stand up and suggest they head back to the store, he heard rustling in the shriveled trees. A wooden platform lifted up from the ground. Out of it crawled two young men. "Oh, I'm so full," Ponsy was saying. "And we still have enough honey buns to last the week. We won't need to get up early for breakfast." Hidden in the bush, Kenzie, Charlie, and Vahid looked up at Uncle Louis. He nodded knowingly and put his finger to his lips. "I hope Nancy is okay," Ponsy said nervously.
"She'll be fine," Odin scoffed. "I didn't hit her that hard. Next time she'll know better than to try and stop us."
Uncle Louis stood up and came out of hiding. His arms were folded across his chest. "Why are you coming out of the ground?" he asked. Ponsy looked worried. Odin was surprised.
"We're just getting ready for a new day," Odin chuckled. "Nice of you all to come by and say good morning."
"We heard from your own mouths about your violent actions," Uncle Louis told him. "You just admitted that you are responsible for hurting Nancy and robbing the store."
"Robbing the store?" Odin laughed. "That makes it sound really bad. We just helped ourselves to some honey buns a little earlier than most, that's all."
"And why was Nancy hurt?"
"Well, if she'd held the door open, we would have thanked her politely," Odin smirked.
"You hurt Nancy. You forced your way into the locked store and you stole from everyone," Uncle Louis said angrily. "This is a very serious matter. There will be no more food for either of you until you apologize and begin to make amends."
"I'm not too worried," Odin replied. "We've got enough to last a while."
For a moment, Uncle Louis imagined dragging the two unrepentant young men across to the schoolhouse and tying them tightly to the posts until they broke down in tears. He felt that violently robbing the store and showing no remorse deserved far worse consequences than could be handed out in paradise.
"We'll have plenty of work for you to do when you get hungry," he replied angrily. "You'll be kept busy all day long for at least 2 weeks. Your terrible treatment of another tiny has cost you your freedom."
"Yeah, well, not today," Odin retorted. Feeling that he was about to lose his temper in a shameful way, Uncle Louis turned around without another word. He tried hard to calm down as he walked back to the store with Vahid, Kenzie, and Charlie following. Silently, he reminded himself, empathy, healing, awareness, persuasion. Everything I do must be for the benefit of my family. How can I help Odin? How can I help Ponsy? Only he was beginning to doubt that the professor's gentle methods worked for everyone.
"I've tried so hard," he pondered, "and they are just not getting it. Will they ever?"
In times like these, Louis's acute awareness that the professor was often watching his actions, the total trust that had been placed on him alone, and the intimate conversations he could always count on having with his father helped him to find extra strength to overcome damaging reactions. Yet his frustration was growing. He felt sometimes that he was only one step away from overreacting in a way that would disappoint everyone.
"I also may have a heavenly father," he told himself as he trudged silently in front of the others.
His research was leading him to believe that he did.
"If God is real, he also watches me all the time. He even knows my thoughts."
Vahid spoke up. "You're leaving all the honey buns with them? They won't need food for days." "It may not seem fair right now," Uncle Louis muttered, "but those boys will get hungry and then they will face their consequences."
"But what if they keep breaking into the store?" Charlie questioned.
"I'm going to offer to trade houses with Nancy," the older Tawny assured them with rigid determination. "From now on, anyone who breaks into the store at night will have to contend with me." Thank you. Chapter 40. The secret is out. Jax did not sleep well after attending the preliminary tribunal hearing. He and Evan had faced the ethics committee, the university board of governors, and their chancellor, and he was crushed that his fabulous project had been so negatively received. As he drove to the rainforest biome very early the next morning, he was sober and subdued. "Perhaps if everything had turned out like I thought it would, there wouldn't have been such a backlash," he considered. "Or if I hadn't made so many mistakes, or if the Tinies were more content. If only they were happier." Getting out of his car, he hardly noticed the gorgeous shades of pinks intertwined across the brightening sky. Golden rays of sunlight highlighted large cumulus clouds as all the colors intensified rapidly. Walking through the elaborate gardens with so many diverse and beautiful flowers lining both sides of the sidewalk, the professor's eyes were fixed on the well-laid stone path. He was depressed that the board wanted to end his tenure at the university and massive fines would be slapped on him. Sadly, he realized he was likely to become internationally notorious as a researcher who had illegally miniaturized human beings rather than the one who had created a true paradise. As troubling as all this was, it wasn't what pained him the most. Jax LeMans had always expected to pay a heavy price for his decision to use the incredible knowledge he'd stumbled upon. What disturbed him even more was that his enormous effort and expense hadn't given his children the complete joy that he thought it would, nor had he discovered any revolutionary secrets that might lead to a better world. "If I've only learned one thing," he considered glumly, "it's that the end doesn't justify the means. I have made a grave mistake." As he entered the biome, the spider monkeys were chattering away in the tall trees. Warm sunshine shone through the glass walls and the humid tropical air gently enveloped him. He could hear the surging waterfall at the other end of the glass building as the toucans and macaws called out their early morning greetings. "As long as they don't put me in jail, I'll still be able to visit here," he reminded himself. He was fairly confident that he and Evan would remain the guardians of paradise as long as the last Tiny existed. No committee member would put 20 little human lives in jeopardy by removing the only researchers who knew how to miniaturize their food, plants, and livestock. "And the way legal proceedings happen in our country," he mused wistfully, "it may be years before they have this all sorted out." Evan came bursting through the front doors. "Jack, it's on social media." "What?" the professor queried. "Already?" Holding up his phone, Evan showed him a Facebook post on the Greenville Biosphere page. A photograph of the notorious researcher in his crisp black suit stared back at him on the screen. The headline read, "Professor LeMans faces enormous fines." Below, a long article written by a young journalist explained the unethical experiment. Numerous references were made to the negative publicity that would result, damaging the esteemed reputation of the university and biosphere. "He must have got hold of the tribunal hearing transcript," Jack sighed. "Get ready to manage the press," Evan groaned. Stroking his graying goatee, the professor considered his best options moving forward. "I have a voice recording in place," he mused. "We'll likely have to give a media interview. At this point, we are giving priority to scientific research. Once Paradise is open to the public in May, we will provide full disclosure to everyone." Evan nodded. "I'm glad you've thought this through." "Best for us to give a first-hand account of our experiment," Jax relayed despondently. "We don't want the media to distort our motives or sensationalize the difficulties." "Which they will," Evan interjected. Before he had finished speaking, a cricket chirp was heard, then another. The professor reached for his phone. He looked at the number. "Oh, la," he said with a sigh. "It's Canadian Broadcasting." "Well, I have a class to prepare for this morning and a family to check on, so I'll let this ring through to voicemail." By lunchtime that day, many of the students had come across the Greenville Biosphere leading story and were sharing it on Instagram and Twitter. Not many were aware that Evan was involved until Jim began to spread that detail far and wide. He had finally found the answer to all his unsuccessful probing, and it was wilder than his most imaginative speculations. Proudly, he declared himself to be the former roommate of the professor's only assistant. Evan met Seth coming out of his discovering biodiversity class. I just heard about the Tinies, the younger student exclaimed with grave concern. This is almost unbelievable. You really have a world of miniature human beings? You've made your own paradise? Evan, I find it hard to believe that this is, well, ethical. Evan shook his head sadly. He knew that Seth was disappointed in his choices, and rightly so. For all the professor's deliberations on right and wrong and who was just and unjust, somehow they had both convinced themselves 5 years ago that it was right to do something that everyone on the university board thought was wrong. It's not ethical, he admitted heavily to his friend, and we're about to face major consequences that we deserve. But it is real. I got into this before I knew better, before I realized I might be tampering with, well, God's creation. I shouldn't have got involved, but it seemed like such an exciting project at the time. He sighed. And now I'm in so deep I have to stay the course. The Tinies are actual human beings who depend on us for their survival. Shaking his head, Seth continued quietly. Now I understand about the fairy clothes and the houses and tiny furniture. Well, when will Greenville University students get to see the display? Will we be included with the scientists? I believe students will have to wait another month for the public viewing, Evan relayed. Then he paused and smiled. However, perhaps the professor would allow me to take in a visitor, once he is in a better frame of mind. He's a little rattled at the moment. A bleep sounded on Evan's phone. It was a message from Jax. Hey, Evan, I have an interview to do with Canadian Broadcasting tonight. I'd like you to join me if you can. Of course, Evan texted back. Since he and Seth both had other courses to attend that morning, they said a quick goodbye and headed off in separate directions. During the lab session, plenty of students asked the tall blonde researcher about paradise. A steady stream of text messages was coming in on his phone. He had to turn off his notifications. Full disclosure will be provided to the public in May, was a flat answer he copied to everyone. Professor Lemans had taken special care with his appearance for the TV interview, dressing up in the crisp black suit that was generally only seen in the life-size portraits hanging in the entrances to the biosphere. I'm only agreeing to one media interview until Paradise is open to the public, he told Evan as they headed out. We must be careful not to give away anything unnecessary tonight. If you feel unsure about answering any question, simply give our line. Evan repeated the answer he had given many times that day. With a wan smile, the professor nodded. Stick to it, he said. The interview was difficult. Tom Freeman was well known for goading his interviewees with questions that provoked public outcries. He wanted to know if the professor had dreamed about creating his own miniature world while he was still a child. He asked if the Paradise experiment was the real reason the professor had donated so much money towards building the biosphere. He prodded the professor on his family life, or lack of it, wanting to know if the professor was fulfilling some innate desire to have many children. Jax tried to be discreet. However, he did tell the story of his first experiment with the geranium and his great surprise when the tiny plant took root and thrived. He explained how his research had led to tiny animals and the discovery that such mammals could only live with a finely calculated ratio of concentrated oxygen. Tom berated him for going against the ethics committee and performing such experiments in secret. Yes, I realize now that I should not have embarked on this project secretly, Jax admitted. Nor gone against the Canadian Code of Ethics. That was wrong, and I will suffer major consequences from this decision for the rest of my life. However, my hope from the beginning was that this project would assist our study of human life and the damaging effect of suffering upon our species. Has it? Jax cleared his throat. Well, the Tinies are very happy, creative, and appreciative, he replied, speaking for at least half of them. They demonstrate, for the most part, that providing the human race with freedom from oppression, catastrophe, and burdensome rulemaking allows us to fulfill our full potential for happiness and individual expression. And has your hypothesis been proven? Is everyone happy and cooperative all of the time? Evan winced slightly. Swallowing hard, the professor chose his words carefully. After witnessing 18 months of rapid development among the Tinies, I do believe that the teen years present some difficulties that may completely dissipate in another 6 or 7 months as they work things out. They are considerably happier, safer, and more cooperative than any human society I've ever observed. Tom Freeman had observed Evan's wince and turned his attention to the tall researcher with the spiky blonde hair. Do you agree with Professor LeMans that his hypothesis is correct? As the professor said, Evan relayed evenly, for the most part, the paradise population is happy, creative, and very appreciative of their world. We have a card on display which was painted and signed by the inhabitants. By all the inhabitants? Tom prodded with a twinkle in his eye. Are there certain individuals refusing to comply? Full disclosure will be provided once public viewing begins, Professor piped up. That question was directed toward your assistant, Tom laughed. What's your view, Evan? Evan was not to be divided from the professor. I agree with Professor LeMans, he said. You see, we aren't forcing any particular behavior in paradise. We are simply providing an ideal environment with minimal consequences for negative behavior, and we're studying the results. All the inhabitants are individuals in their own right, and therefore respond in unique ways to their environment. Any fair scientific study in any field will have varying results at some level. Tom tried a few different questions to see if Evan would divulge any more details in regard to the minimal consequences and varying results, but Evan remained tight-lipped. Turning back to the professor, Tom asked, "Human life cannot begin without a father and a mother. Where did all these tinies come from?" Acknowledging that this was a fair question, the professor replied, "I only used human reproductive cells that were specifically donated for unrestricted scientific research. I believe that this project has important scientific and social implications, which we are only beginning to discover." Content with his answer, Tom Freeman prodded on another point. "What is the long-term sustainability of this experiment?" he asked. "What happens to the tiny should you suddenly be unable to care for them?" The professor looked at Evan, wondering whether to answer this question or choose their standard reply. Evan gave him a look of encouragement, unsure himself how best to respond. Professor LeMans chose to answer. "Due to the repression of stored energy in the cell structure of the tinies, they are demonstrating a rapid aging process. Aside from the first tiny, the rest have been alive for 18 months. They are already maturing into their late teen years. I'm not exactly sure what their life expectancy will be, but so far 1 month seems equivalent to 1 year." "What if they have children?" Shaking his head, Jax replied, "All the tiny mammals have been so far unable to reproduce. The University Ethics Committee has forbidden us to introduce any new human life, and therefore we don't expect this project to exceed my lifespan. If some unexpected interruption occurs, Evan will certainly be able to see it through." Tom Freeman frowned as he did a few quick calculations in his head. "So, if 1 month equals 1 year," he mused, "then I suppose they won't likely live past 100 months, which is approximately 8 or 9 years. Looking perturbed, he asked, "Do your tinies realize they have less than 10 years to live?" Professor LeMans hesitated and then asked, "How many teenagers do you know that spend a lot of time considering how long they have to live?" "Not many, of course," Tom agreed. "But 10 years will be over quite quickly. That's the age of a child." Evan spoke up. "Time is relative." "However you want to spin it," Tom smirked. "It seems to me that these tinies don't have very long to enjoy their beautiful paradise." "True," the professor conceded. "But if you could choose between 6 or 7 years full of happiness with safe, pleasurable activity, or 70 years with heartache, fear, and sorrow, which would you prefer?" 70 years of heartache sounds rather pessimistic to me," Tom reprimanded with a chuckle, pleased to have found a debatable issue. "I think we should invite our listeners to contribute to this discussion." Opening up his show to the public, he looked directly at the cameras. "Call in if you have an opinion in regard to the professor's proposal. What would you choose if you had the choice? 6 years of happiness in paradise or 70 years of heartache in our world?" Evan looked over at the professor, whose eyes were downcast, as he shook his head regretfully. The phones began ringing. A commercial break was inserted while Tom took calls from all over the country. Few callers thought they would be happy with the 6-year option, but many derided the professor for beginning a creation with such a limited lifespan. Tom happily played along, loving the controversial nature of the dialogue and fanning the flames of dissent. Evan and the professor frequently resorted to their one-liner and watched the clock anxiously, waiting for the half-hour interview to be over. They both felt as though their bubble had burst. Pandora's box had been opened, and it could never be shut again.